My name is Raoul Victor. I come from France, from Paris. And I have been a Marxist ever since the early 60s. Marxist is a very vague name, so I think useful to add that I never considered the so-called communist or socialist regimes of the 20th century as being anything else than state capitalism. I think that identifying state capitalism with communism has been one of the most poisonous lies of the 20th century. I've been participating in English economics mailing lists ever since 2002 because I share the idea that free software and more generally peer production are germ forms of the future post-capitalist society. Well, that gives an idea of who I am. The subject of this workshop is money and peer production. I try to deal with the question of the relations between these two realities, money and peer production. What are the relations today and what they might be in the future, especially if one thinks that peer production is a germ of the future society. The question is not so simple. First of all, because money and peer production rely on different and antagonistic principles. Money is based on exchange, on symmetric exchange. And I think it's important to clear on that point that very often we use the word exchange is used in different meanings. Normally, exchange means that inevitably a symmetric exchange. You're giving something, you receive something, which is equivalent. But exchange is also used in a very general meaning. So I will always say symmetric exchange, to be precise, it's the same thing which is given from one side to the other. So I give you something and you give me something of equivalent value. Money, as a universal equivalent of value, is used first to allow that exchange, the first function. Second, to measure the value of what is exchanged. And third, to hoard the value of what is exchanged. On the contrary, peer production is not based on any symmetrical exchange. There is not exchange of equivalents at any level of the process of production. There are different definitions of peer production, insisting more or less on different aspects of it. I will use here something close to Michel Bowen's definition of P2P, which refers to the three moments of the process. The first level is input, and here we have raw material, which has to be open and free, gratis. The second level is the process of production itself, of collaboration, where collaboration is based on voluntary participation and not on wage or coercion. Third, the output, the result of the collaboration, is universally available. It's also free and gratis. How these two antagonistic realities can relate to each other? The answer depends on the situation in which we deal with the problem. If we think that one day a full developed peer society will exist, it's clear that things will be different according to the advancement of the process which leads to such a situation. Thus, I will deal with three specific moments. First, within the framework of dominant capitalism. Second, in a period of transition. And this period of transition, I'll define it as the moment in which peer production will begin to extend to the material world of production. And the third moment, that will be very short, is in a full developed peer society. I had thought at the beginning, as I wrote in the abstract of this workshop, that I would follow here the germ form theory and its five steps model, Stefan Meretz and and Stefan Merten. But finally, I realized that it was a little bit too long to explain that theory, so I just make something more simple and just kept these three moments. But before going forward, I think it's necessary to say a few words about a frequent idea that you say that money and symmetric exchange are something natural, something almost inherent to human nature, something which has always been naturally accepted by human beings and that therefore that will always exist. Symmetric exchange, in fact, did not exist within the all primitive communities. Within these communities, there was no private property nor exchange. Production and distribution were organized as in a big family. Exchange developed first as a marginal activity at the fringes of these communities through the exchange between the communities, and it developed under the form of direct barter. Animal furs against salt, for example. That was a collective exchange between communities. The first forms of money appear later under the form of commodity money, a specific good, common and directly useful to all, is used as mean of exchange. Many goods have been used as such, shells in the five continents, grains, oil, cattle. For example, the Roman word for money, pecunia, which gives pecuniary, derives from pecus, which means cattle. Later, precious metals, silver or gold, have been used as money. It's only around the 6th century, before Christ, that fiat money or state money appears in Greece and probably a little bit later in China. But exchange through money will remain essentially marginal during almost 1,000 years before the development of capitalism. And in the slave societies, like Greece or the Roman Empire, as in the feudal society, the main economic activity remains agriculture, and by far. And at that level, between the slave and his master, or between the serf and his lord, the relation is a direct relation, and the contributions are made in direct form in nature or in the form of work. Capitalism, it's only with capitalism that money will play a dominant role in social life. Capitalism places money at the heart of the two main dimensions which define a mode of production. I think that mode of production is defined essentially by the goal of production and the way the producers, the main producers, participate in production. Profit, under the form of money, becomes the real goal of production in capitalism. And at the same time, wages, paid with money, become the medium for most workers to participate in production. The labor force becomes a commodity by itself and has a money price in a specific market. The tendency to imagine that the present use of money is something natural coming from the beginning of humanity is completely wrong. Another common and wrong idea is that symmetric exchange and money were naturally accepted since the beginning of their existence. In fact, the rejection and the mistrust of money are very old. In the 4th century before Christ, Aristotle, for example, made a pitiless criticism of money, of exchange itself, opposed to household management. He wrote, for example, quotation, "There are two sorts of wealth getting. One is a part of household management, the other is retail trade. The former is necessary and honorable, while that which consists in exchange is justly censored, for it is unnatural and a mode by which men gain from one another." He also wrote that, and that's a nice sentence, "All paid jobs absorb and degrade the mind." You can also find a rejection of exchange in the Bible, for example. with the famous passage about Jesus chasing the merchants from the temple. More generally, I would say that the same mistress, it's the same mistress which explains that in all the heavens, of at least all the heavens, the idea of heaven that has been developed by different religions, you never find symmetric exchange, or you never find money. With the development of capitalism, criticism of money became more frequent and more radical. Thomas More, for example, as soon as the 16th century, makes that criticism in his Utopia. He imagines a society without money, even if they had money to exchange between different parts of it, but within the city, there is no money. The diggers in England in the 17th century said that when humanity started to sell and buy, it lost its innocence. The anti-capitalistic socialist movements that appeared as from the 19th century naturally developed and radicalized that rejection. So, no, symmetric exchange and money are not natural and have not been easily accepted by humans along history. Well, that was a long parenthesis, but I think it's important to see how the absence of symmetric exchange and money in the peer production relationships are an achievement of an all-human ambition. But let's go back to the main question, the relations between money and peer production. And let's deal first with this relation within the framework of dominant capitalism. In a capitalist society, peer production is inevitably dependent, direct or indirectly, on capitalist money, since hackers and all peer producers need money to make a living. And in such a society, one needs money to get food or even to get computers. Of course, money can be accepted in order to develop a peer production free software project, for example. But then the main preoccupation, the main condition, is that this money do not subvert the core logic of the project. Can get it from by different ways, but it's important that the logic of the system, the logic of peer production, is not corrupted, and especially that the product at the end is universally available. But things are not so simple. Capitalism has understood the profit it can get from forms of peer production and has developed hybrid forms where capitalist relationships are mixed with peer production. One of the most significant examples is the participation of capitalist corporations, as IBM, for example, to the production of free software, especially the case of Linux. If we refer to the main three characteristics of peer production, as I said, taking input, production, and output, and being free and open input, free volunteering production, universally available outputs, one can say that here we have a hybrid aspects at the three moments of the process. First, at the level of the inputs, the raw material is partly capitalistic, as the computer, the offices, etc., are privately owned by IBM. At the same time, for the raw material, a part of it is simply free software. To make free software is also part of the raw material. At the second level, the level of production, this is not based on free volunteering, but some aspects of the production are new, non-capitalistic, as for example, the cooperation between programmers of antagonistic corporations. In IBM, it's funny to see the programmers of IBM communicating with competitors of IBM, what did you find, and putting together their results. And at the same time, they are working in a very typical capitalist corporation. Third, at the level of the output, the results of this production where corporations participate can be more or less oriented towards commercial needs, for example. But in any case, we see that the output remains universally available. Linux, for example, is produced with the help of IBM or Sun and becomes and remains gratis. The social networking also generates hybrid forms. Let's consider, for example, MySpace or YouTube. At the level of the input, this is partly capitalistic, the infrastructures and the financing by advertising, for example. But for the rest, most of the inputs, video, blogs, etc., are free and open. At the level of production, the process is based partially on capitalist wage relations for the infrastructure management, but the rest is based, again, on free volunteering. At the third level, the output is supposed to be universally available. Anyone can see a film in MySpace or YouTube, but you cannot load it very frequently, and corporations impose limits and try to extend these limits, provoking open conflicts with users and producers. One example, a recent example is, I don't know if you have seen that, something which is called, a site which is called Why I Am Deleting MySpace Account and Why You Should Do Too. You don't know, it's a site which is saying, denouncing the how MySpace and YouTube are using the work of a lot of people to make profit. Hybrid forms also developed in the past transitions between modes of productions. Between the 6th century and the 10th century, many landlords, including the church, had simultaneously slaves and serfs, or colony. Colony were the first forms of serfs. Between the 12th century and the 19th century, many hybrid forms developed, especially in the cities, where capitalism developed within feudal relationships. In the past, the evolution of this form has been often very slow, with periods of acceleration, but also periods of recession. And I think there is a very interesting example. It's the example of the Arsenal of Venice. In the early 16th century, the Arsenal of Venice could employ some 16,000 people and could produce almost a ship per day using production lines. And these ships were not only the ship, but also with weapons in it. Something like this won't happen till the 19th century with the Industrial Revolution. So between the 16th and the 19th century, this big progress will recess. And it's a good image of how the evolution of these hybrid forms is not something not regular, and especially it's a not linear evolution. The dynamic of that evolution depends on many factors. The evolution of technologies is one of them, but it's far from explaining everything. Here, the social consciousness, the social and political conflicts play a crucial role. For example, in the past, the European wars of religion after the 16th century and the bourgeois revolution of the 17th to 19th century were indirect or direct expressions of the conflict between the old feudal logic and the rising capitalistic one. Today, in the present conflicts concerning the use of peer production, aspects by capitalist corporations, we're witnessing the same kind of conflict between the old logic and the new. The dynamic of that logic depends and will depend not only on material technological realities, but also on social and political struggles at micro and macro scales. And things will probably become harsher when peer production will pretend to extend to the realm of material production. Finally, just a remark about the role of advertising in the financing of some hybrid forms of peer production. It's true that many products that we can find free, gratis in internet are in fact financed behind by advertising. And I think it's a good expression of manifestation of this idea of Hegel, who said that history advances by its dark side. The reality of the relations between some forms of peer production and capitalism are a good illustration of that. Many free, gratis services offered in the web are financed by the advertising, but advertising is Goebbels. Advertising is based on techniques developing Pavlovian reflex in the population in order to make them to buy specific goods. It's based on the famous Goebbels formula: a lie repeated 1,000 times becomes a truth. To a certain extent, the development of non-market relations remains dependent on one of the darkest sides of the capitalist totalitarian manipulation. In that sense, as long as material means of production remain under the capitalistic logic governance, the peer production realities will be, in a way or another, limited. But let's consider now what could be the relations between money and peer production in a situation where the material means of production begin to be collectively owned, put into commons. As I said at the beginning of this presentation, I considered that the beginning of this transition would be this fact of putting owning collectively the means of production would be the beginning of a new period of transition. One can say that in this evolution, everything is transition. To a certain extent, there is a transition which started as the beginning, since the beginning of peer production. But it's clear that if at one moment or the other, when peer production will extend to material production, when the means of production will be in the hands of the commons, this will start a new transition. I won't really deal here with the question of how the material means of production will become part of the commons. Some people think that this will be the result of a pacific evolution of capitalism led by enlightened sector of the ruling class. Michel is one of the perspectives he will discuss tomorrow, for example. Others think that it will become from the cooperation and aggregation of small communities. Michel also thinks that is another way. For me, I would say that I think that it will be mainly, even if it's not only, the result of global social and political struggles, where the main protagonists will be the working people, the population directly exploited by capitalist relationships. But let's leave for the moment this problem aside. It's not the object of the discussion, but just start how, let's see the problem in this new situation. The situation would be the following: a significant share of material means of production, factories, power plants, oil fields, land, etc., become collectively owned in one or many countries. That's a difficult question, but just imagine some countries for the moment. But because we are just coming out from a world dominated by scarcity or limitness, it is impossible to apply immediately the principle of peer production or the principle of commonism to each according to his needs and desires without limits. As things are not, if you don't have abundance, such a distribution is impossible. The question is then, how can be organized the distribution of goods collectively produced? Since symmetric exchange and money have been the most efficient necessary evil to manage situations where scarcity exists, are they here an inevitable necessity? I don't have a definitive, clear answer on that. I don't pretend to solve that very complex problem. But I would like here only to make three kind of remarks or comments. One is about some lessons of history. The second is about the classical Marxist answers to that question, especially the Marxist text of the critique of the Gotha program. And third, I'll try to make a proposition for solving that problem. Well, the first thing is about the lesson of history. I think we need to be careful not to have a fetishistic vision of money. You cannot abolish money without eliminating the necessity of symmetric exchange. Money is not a fetish having specific powers by itself. It's just expression of symmetric exchange. And it's impossible to destroy it if the need of symmetric exchange remains. The Argentinian experience, we probably know in 2001, when the state was in bankruptcy and the state was unable to produce money, show how in a situation of scarcity, if official money disappears, money reemerges spontaneously from the need of exchange to survive. During the Second World War, for example, cigarettes were used as money because they couldn't find money, so cigarettes played that role. And cigarettes are still playing a role of money in the prisons of the United States, for example. On a much larger scale, during the 20th century, there were many situations, especially during the first years of the Russian Revolution or in periods of war, where the governments tried to ban free exchange and restrict the power of money in order to impose rationing. The result was always the same. Money reappeared, and especially exchange and the market reappeared, but in its worst form, in the form of black market. During the Russian Revolution, for example, at the beginning when they really tried to and had the idea to eliminate money and eliminate the market, the black market appeared and the prices there were 50 times higher than the official price fixed by the government. So money, you can decide and make plenty of laws and repression. If the material conditions for the elimination of symmetric exchange doesn't exist, money, it's impossible to abolish money. Symmetric exchange and money will disappear only when the need for it has disappeared, when abundance, or rather ampleness, which is, you understand, ampleness is doesn't exactly the same as abundance, has been reached, when abundance has been reached for produced goods, a good example is the example of air, for example, or water, when you don't need to exchange air or to pay air or to pay water. Water, not in a city, but if you live close to the sea, for example, you don't need to pay or to sell the water of the sea. In the internal world of free software and peer production, money has disappeared not only because of ethic convictions, but because of the intrinsic nature of digital goods, which makes them abundant and as soon as they are created. If symmetric exchange is needed, money is required. And if money is needed, we must assume it and try to find the ways to prevent all its most negative aspects, and in particular, the possibility to accumulate money and the power of the issuing organs. As we know, one of the worst aspects of money is it allows to accumulate value, and so to create rich people and to create people who have power over the other in the society. At that level, newly designed money, electronics and P2P open a lot of possibilities. But in any case, all this new design money, is to use that formula, in any case, that would only be a provisional, a lesser evil solution. It's not, in that sense, I would say that the word or the formula of peer money is a contradiction in the terms. It doesn't mean that money will disappear in such a period of transition, but in any case, it's not part of the solution. It's something we're obliged to accept. Well, the second point is a few comments about one of classical solutions to the problem of how to distribute the production in a situation of scarcity, the movement towards a full developed peer society. The classical Marxist solution, as it's developed, especially in the Marx text, which was a secret text, the critique of the Gotha program.
What do you mean secret? It was published in the lifetime of Marx.
It's very funny. I mean, in fact, he wrote that, it was in the great discussion between the German Social Democratic Party at the creation. And the Gotha program is a critique of the Lassallian people. He wrote that letter to one of the members of the party who was working with him and asked him, you keep that letter secret. I mean, it's just for us. And this letter remained secret after the Russian Revolution. It was discovered after, as a text, after it became a very important text and it's very often quoted. But Marx didn't write it for to be published at the beginning. And it's funny. It's a funny story. For example, especially that during all the Russian Revolution, they didn't know anything. And it's one of the most amazing aspects of the Marxism and all even the revolutionary theories, is that you can find, if you had to put in a wall in a library, how many books have been written criticizing capitalism, you will probably fulfill all the wall, or all, in all this room. But you just try to find how many texts have been written to just say how will be the new society. It's a very, very small world. And one of the main texts, the Critique of Gotha, was a secret text. It's a paradox. And that's why it's so important now to work on that aspect.
Question. Would you say this applies also to the civil war in France?
Can I finish on that after we can see the questions after, right? Well, the program of Gotha, the solution which is proposed, I won't develop it here all, but it can be summarized by the formula to each according to his work. We cannot have to each according to his needs, but to each according to the work he makes. In principle, that would be an overcoming of capitalism, since capitalism's basic definition of capitalism is that any worker, is paid according to the value of his labor force. Here it would be a transformation. It's according to the work he has done. But in order to function, that system needs a complex and huge effort of measuring. On the one hand, it must measure the value of each producer's contribution, calculated in abstract labor, simple labor. On the other hand, the value, which measured the value of each product, that poses difficulties at a qualitative and a quantitative level. At a qualitative level, first, it poses the question of making a distinction between what is considered work or necessary work. And you have to make a distinction between that and work which would be for pleasure or for leisure. And that's already something difficult and qualitatively difficult. The second is that the transformation of complex work is what is the work made by workers who are experienced or educated. And normally, as we are using the simple work as a measure, we have to transform that work on simple work. And that's a really particularly hazardous task, if it's not impossible. At a quantitative level, measuring how many hours everyone is working, and on the other side, what is the value of each product and each service, all that implies a quantity of effort, which one can wonder if it's not a hindrance rather than a factor of fluency. With internet and P2P today, it will be much easier and simple to calculate immediately not the exchange value, but the use value of what is produced and what are the needs. And that's the main, I think that at that level, it's a, if Marx had known and had seen the new technologies, would probably change, she would have probably proposed something different. The measurement of labor contribution is supposed to create or maintain a motivation for participation, for participating in social production. And that's an important point. Normally, the general argument, not only in Marxist, but in general, it's work, measuring work, is and remunerating work, is the main, is kept as a motivation for work. But as such, this motivation is based on the old bourgeois principles. If you do not work, you do not eat. If you don't work enough, you won't have enough, and this regardless of the social possibilities. I think that to learn to participate to the social production in a different way, that under the whip and the blackmail of individual starvation, under economic coercion, that seems a basic need as soon as we have the possession of the main means of production. The reality of peer production brings the evidence that it is not so utopian and impossible, and it's not an impossible dream. For example, who would have said only 20 years ago that products like Linux or Wikipedia, representing millions of hours of work, could have been realized without any economical coercion? Why would it not be the case with material production? The social atmosphere created by the fact that means of production are on the hands of society, that production is oriented towards the human needs in the commons, should engender an enthusiasm and a collective spirit which could be the most powerful motivation to participate to production without economic individual coercion. But most important, in a society where the means of production are not privately owned anymore, the organization of production in every place can be the task and made by the producers themselves. That's something that very often we don't think when we talk about the theory of the end user innovation. Usually we always think of the end user innovation for consumer goods, but very rarely we see the end user innovation for producers. The product, the people working, are the end users of the means of production. And the if the means of production are in the commons, it's the producers themselves who should decide what to do and how they have to be made. The design of the producer's means of production can be essentially specified according to the pleasure they can offer to their users. Transforming the world of production in order to make it a pleasant one should be a top priority since the beginning of a post-capitalist transition. As far as things will depend on humans' will, we should rather bet on such a method than on individual economic coercion as an incentive to participate to production. Well, and the third point is a timid proposition. Because the question remains, as far as there is still not a sufficient abundance of goods and capacities of production in order to allow free and unlimited distribution, how to restrict the consumption to the prevailing possibilities of production? If we abandon the wage principle, to each according to the value of his labor force, if we refuse the principle to each according to his work, what principle to use? I only see one possibility, to each according to the social possibilities. It's a sort of to each according to his needs, but limited, restricted by what is really possible, as in a household, or in the domestic economy, or, for example, in a fisher's village, where, after drawing collectively the net, fishes are shared between the population, according to what we have to distribute. This would be a conscious, a direct way of dealing with limitness. It would be a way to deal with the problem in terms of use value and not exchange value. It would be the logic consequence of the fact that the means of production are collectively possessed. If we participate to production as collective possessors, production can be distributed collectively, taking into account permanently and dynamically what is possible and what is needed. Internet and P2P are powerful means to allow that. As already said, P2P networks make possible instantaneous and ubiquitous availability of the necessary information for such a system. The question is then, will consumers respect voluntarily the restrictions when they exist? Is not such a system going to collapse because of multiple abuses? Such a system means a great degree of collective consciousness, of self-responsibility. That may seem wishful thinking when envisaged from the point of view of the capitalist social jungle. But we should not underestimate the changing mentalities which would be induced by a society where production is oriented directly and exclusively towards human needs, where orientation of production is permanently, collectively agreed. One of the most important contributions of free software and peer production has been to prove in practice, with facts, that humans can cooperate, share, and produce the most complex things without money profit, without money incentive, and without state coercion. For example, some people thought that Wikipedia would never develop because it would be permanently destroyed by vandals. The intelligence of Wikipedia has been to have confidence in the collective spirit of contributors, to base its rules on the needs of that confidence and not on the danger represented by vandals. Vandals exist in the beginning of Wikipedia, but they remain a small minority, and the care of the majority has allowed to neutralize the negative action. The same could be done at the level of the distribution of production. Collective consciousness will be a key element in managing the transition into a post-capitalist society. I will make two conclusions. Small, short conclusion. The third moment, and that will be very short, is what would be the relations between money and peer production in a full developed peer society. But at that level, I think that the answer is very simple. In a full peer society, I think we won't need symmetric exchange, as we don't need it in free software, and we won't need money. Maybe somebody would like to play money, but in that case, they could play Monopoly if they like, but it won't be anymore a necessity for humanity. So, for the conclusions, just two ideas. One is that historically, symmetric exchange developed first not at the center of the primitive communities, but at the fringes, through the trade between them. Its movement was from the periphery to the center. I think that the disappearance of exchange and money should follow the reverse process, from the center to the periphery. And the second conclusion is that we are assisting today to two contradictory tendencies in society. One towards a deeper penetration of market relations in all domains of social life. introducing property and money everywhere. I recently read in the P2P Foundation blog that even yoga is being privatized, especially in the US, where there are more than 2,500 copyright patents concerning yoga. Even the Indian government is protesting because it's such an absurd situation.
What in the spiritual practice? I mean, isn't it?
The technique, the moves.
The moves, yeah, the books and everything, but more than 2,000 patents. But that's one tendency, which we can see everywhere, how the low value money is penetrating and everywhere. But there is another tendency, and it's a tendency towards the elimination of property and money, a tendency towards what could be called gratism, even if it's a strange word, I think it's beautiful. The development of the peer production reality is the main aspect of that tendency. Hegel, said that contradiction is the root of all movements and vitality. In front of the collapsing and devastating reality of capitalism, it's urgent to develop, to support the dynamic aspect of that contradiction, the movement towards a full developed peer society. The question of knowing what could be an alternative to the capitalist society is crucial for all the social movements which develop and will develop in the future against the existing order. I think that it is at this level of consciousness that the peer production reality should play a determinant role, even if it will certainly be something in the long run, maybe decades, maybe 20 years or 30 years, somebody was saying today, a century. But I think that that's one of the main aspects of peer production, is as a model of a new society, new relationships, and an alternative, something beyond capitalism. We have seen recently in Greece a very radical movement, but one of the things which was striking is that it hardly could give an idea of what they wanted, what would be a world after capitalism, what can exist beyond capitalism. And I think that's one of the main roles of peer production and the idea of peer production. Voilà. Okay.
Sorry for the interview.
Yeah, just a moment. I don't have a watch, so if somebody can kind of tell me what time it is and how long do we have?
It's 5 o'clock now.
And how long do we have?
We have until 5:30. That's when the
All
next
right.
session starts.
Okay. So sorry. Please, George.
It seems that, I mean, I got the impression that Raoul would... Well, I felt as if the speech was terminated 5 minutes before the actual end. You said, well, we see there is this dynamic, having a positive and a negative side. If you follow Hegel, it's always the negative side that wins. Marx says this also.
That's exactly.
So what are, say, how do you see this conflict playing out? Do you see this time the negative side actually being the one that dominates?
Well, the idea is not, Marx and Hegel don't say the negative. There is no negative or not positive. I quoted the idea of the dark side. The dark side pushes. It's fighting against negative aspects that the positive can develop, or what we call positive. In this case, positive would be what wins by definition, what is the future of history. And I would say that there is a main conflict that I think, even if we have seen that a lot of hybrid forms exist and will develop, the contradiction exists within the hybrid forms itself. But I think it's part of a more general conflict that we can see just today when somebody's closing a factory. A boss is closing a factory, it's the same thing. On one side, he's closing, capital is closing factories just because they're obliged to make it. It's the logic, the capitalist logic, you have no profit, so the factory has to be closed. And the contradiction between the people who say, okay, you don't make profit, but I need to live and I need to feed my children, are two completely antagonistic realities. But in fact, it's the same contradiction, different forms of the same contradiction we see in the two cases, in a hybrid form, or in the conflict between free software and people trying to prevent free things, or, for example, people who in YouTube or MySpace trying to prevent people to download a file. Somewhere it's the same conflicts which are existing.
I mean, continuing with Hegel, he was well known for always considering both sides and to have the positive and the negative. Now, we only got the negative side of money in your account. In fact, I think money is liberating in a variety of ways. Like, for example, if you take care for the elderly, you could, in an utopian or a sort of original mute, you could say, you see, this is humanity, and one should, in some way, exchange on a humanitarian, caritative way. But the problem with this is there are always strings attached. I mean, if there is a non-money exchange in goods and services, as a matter of historical fact, strings are attached to anything you invest. It's expected of you that you will re-invite. It's expected of you that you submit. It's expected of you that you do the household. Whatever. That there are very traditional and very oppressive conditions under which the non-monetary exchange of services, of social relations was developing. Now, Marx knew very well, and Hegel knew very well, that money in some ways liberating, because it liberates you from these sort of oppressive demands that are imposed on you. And it does liberate you exactly because there is this equivalence. Now, I agree with your analysis. On the other hand, there's a heavy burden imposed on our society, and I agree with you that it's too heavy. The burden that once you go into the exchange value equivalence, it's probably a too high a price to pay for freedom. But not to mention the liberating effect of money at all in a talk like this. That's just negligent, if I may say so.
Answer first.
Again, yeah. Just two things. When Marx says money was liberating from feudal traditions or family traditions, he doesn't say that we are arriving to freedom. He says we are effectively liberated from all tradition and the weight, and that was replaced by, as he said, the cold relations of money. Of cash, but he didn't say we are in freedom. We are in a capitalist world, where the freedom is also an idea he gives. It's you are free as a bird, flying. If you don't move, you fly your wings, you die. The you're using an image of Marx when he shows how capital liberated humanity from feudal and all of obscure traditions. But he didn't say that it was freedom. To be obliged to work and to become...
I didn't claim for the freedom. I was just using liberating. It was just liberating. And because I have no notion of the freedom. I have no notion of the state of society which would be freedom. There are interventions that are liberating. And some of the function of money is to liberate me from...
But in that case, I would say just, you are liberated from one system of exploitation to get it into another system of exploitation, which is much more totalitarian, much more deep. And I would say if somebody criticized the new system, the new liberty of capitalism, was Marx. And I think it would be not very honest to say that he just saw in money a way to become more free. Another thing that I wanted to say, I had the impression at the beginning, and I don't know if I understood exactly, that you said, money can also free people or the elderly.
In comparison to the duty to care for them. And from guilt, for example, from guilt by obligation. You're guilty if you don't care for your parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you pay for them, it liberates you from your guilt.
If you
that's not fancy. That's not a fancy idea at all. That's what happens. If you are a woman and your mother and your grandmother used to care for the family, and it's a heavy burden put on women. Now, once they can afford, and once the society is as advanced as being able to afford putting the elderly into a nursing home, I know I'm trying to make this more controversial, but just for the use of discussion. But once this is the case, which is a problem, I agree with you completely. Mm. But at the same time, these women are feel liberated.
Well, I would say, in the same sense, if have another way to solve that is to pay somebody to kill her. Money, you can perfectly, absolutely. You can go and pay, you're free. Instead, if he kills, you won't go to jail. In Colombia, you can very easily buy a person who kills, just kill my family and I'm free.
However, that's a very important dimension. If I may just for a moment say, recently I tried to convince some people that, well, a free society is not utopian. It could be very much realistic. Mm. They're engineers from the TU Delft, technical university. So they told me, for instance, let's assume we have a free society, who would take out the garbage? Would you do it yourself, George, or would there be somebody else being paid to do it? What I'm trying to say is that, indeed, money has a function of mitigating some social costs, or, you know, basically some costs. Of course, this assumes, presupposes that you have the money. So, say I live in a commune. I have to mind the kids once a week to look after the kids of the people who live in the commune. Maybe I'm a lazy bastard and I don't want to look after the kids. I suppose there is a certain irrationality in this argument. How can you live in a commune without being able to partake in all those activities as equal with others? But let's assume I don't like kids. I hate them. But I still live in the commune. So this is the problem you pose, that I would have money, I would employ somebody to look after the kids, so I wouldn't have to do it. Which is indeed the social function of money. We can employ others to do things we hate to do, we don't like to do ourselves. And I think this is pertinent, it's important for many people. How would we address this in a world without money? Would we impose some limitations, some, for instance, we join the commune, you have once a week to look after the kids. Or would there be some way by which all those decisions would emerge from the ground up and people would self-volunteer? I don't know. What's your opinion on this?
I want you to wait a little bit and have Philippe, Dante and you three just make your points and then Raoul will...
Actually, I'm trying to raise, the same issue as... the same question as Herbert, maybe trying to make it less controversial, because I think it was it prevented us from looking at the core issue behind it. And let's say I take another detour. The commons of the past, the ones that were enclosed at the time of the enclosures, they were not paradise. Certainly not for strangers to a community. They were heavily protected against intruders, and they needed to, because these were not times of abundance of grazing land or wood or game or whatever was part of these commons. But also in terms of internal management, they had elements of oppression, and I think oppression by tradition, and one cannot understand the success, even if there were very strong reactions, if the the movement opposing the enclosures and the marketization of a number of things was so powerful that they delayed by sometimes 200 years the events to which they were opposing. What cannot understand that they finally won that element without reference to the fact that people did adhere in vast numbers to the liberation element in it. I mean, but the closed communities to which you were forced to belong, and not you didn't belong by choice, you were forced to belong, and that were imposing rules on you and not rules that you were building, and were really oppressive, and not only money, but markets, every the birth of mediation was fully liberating.
I would like to comment.
So what, from what? What I would be expecting from you would be to tell us now we have something which in the information sphere is even more liberating because we can define rules of our choice, we can have people who come and go to participate in collective efforts without the sustainability of the effort itself being damaged. So we have a model I don't want to be controversial again, but could be seen as hyper market. I mean, something even more than a market in terms of fluidity of. And the question becomes, how can this retroact on the activities that are in the physical or social sphere, where, you know, my mother has Alzheimer's, it's not fun to care for her. I mean, it's painful. And the fact that you can pay people doesn't mean you're not going to do it. Actually, I believe it's a condition for doing it. If you don't get assistance in doing it, I have witnessed in rural France what happens to aged people whose families, quote, forced to care for them. I mean, it's not good treatment. And so, how do you see that something which will be past currency or a new form of currency or new form of combination between what people do voluntarily and what people are incited to do by incentives? It's tautology, but how do you see that?
Too long. So let's finish with Dante, you, and then you.
Okay. Oh. There will be a comment in this direction.
Let's follow the order because they've been waiting for quite a while. Yeah, Dante and then you.
My perception is that we're talking about information system architectures and money being one kind of information system. But then, which kind of money are we talking about? Which kind of monetary architecture? The current, we've been talking about fiat money, about the evolution of money and the use of money in the time. And what are we evolving to? We often talk about money currently as debt money. Maybe we could imagine information systems. And sometimes I'm a bit troubled because I don't know what to define as money. If we have a gift information system, is it still money? I don't know. So that's something I'm wondering.
I was wondering whether this is a discussion of money is a bit of a void. You talk about scarcity and the possibility of getting rid of money until we get rid of scarcity. Mm-hmm. Yes, scarcity is greater in more unequal the society.
Mm-hmm.
Inequality creates scarcity. So, should not equality inequality be a dimension of this discussion? You talk about the relief, the liberation that money gives in the case of care for the elderly, without any wish to diminish in any sense the suffering people go through looking after somebody who has Alzheimer's. There are other societies that regard with horror the way we treat our old people, and people who support old people who wouldn't dream of it couldn't be. Now, I think that this problem of care of the elderly is one of many examples of the way that the need for money comes in when societies are unequal. I could go on and phrase a length about inequality. But I better not, I suppose.
I will translate because So it's basically about the dimension.
Si tu ne parles pas français, c'est mieux.
Donc le essentiellement, c'était ce que la rareté qui crée le besoin de la monnaie est renforcée par l'inégalité, et que donc dans notre discours, on doit tenir compte de l'égalité. Et il a mentionné le fait que dans certains pays, on critique très fort notre façon de traiter avec l'argent les personnes âgées, par exemple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Johan, you want to say, and then Roken.
I will try to be very quick. I was just thinking, he spoke me when you were saying this thing. I agree with what you said. I think that the sort of the aligning, like the capital aligning with those people being oppressed, I think, was a very powerful force of sort of splintering the possibility of organizing your resistance and so on. And we can see that in many levels today as well. But I was thinking that taking the old comments as an example, there is. Yes, if we want to make a parallel with the critique of the comments of Garrett Harrow Parliament, from a very liberal point of this perspective, saying that comments lead to tragedies because
nobody cares for them.
Yeah, I don't know if everyone is familiar with the idea. So just quickly, that he sort of imposes a capitalist way of, or a liberal economic way of thinking of the comments from outside, and by doing those conclusions to the end, he sees that the comments are always unstable and because people are rational, maybe maximizing the system. So in that case, Harding has imposed or projected an idea from his time onto. And I'm thinking, maybe to some extent, we do the same when there was a liberation coming, a sensation of liberation, but this sort of...
I don't know, because if you reread Harding, which is quite an interesting exercise, and also a book that was published 1 year after his paper, revisited the tragedy, revisiting the tragedy of the commons. You see that he says, okay, there will be a tragedy of the commons if either someone doesn't own them, so they are no longer commons, or they are not, or they are managed. And we all know that management doesn't work, which was a purely ideological statement. I mean, he took really half of his own reasoning to say, okay, the only thing that will work is ownership. And the whole history of the traditional commons tells us that management did work.
Yes,
but the problem is management at that time was based on keeping intact structures that were sort of very hostile to the autonomy of the individual. And, and let's say I also visit the societies who are horrified and actually, I'm horrified myself at how we treat our, how I treat my elderly. This said, even in both societies, the power of anything that enables more autonomy in the individual is considerable. So the question is, can we articulate this autonomy with a collective management, and we were not in this management is a new form to use it, but a collective organization of the provision of some qualities, services, I don't know. That was my question, and it's I still don't know. I mean, I still, but I think mixed things are good. That is taking. I think we can learn from the historic, the traditional way of having the elderly being part of an environment, rather accepting its derelict states as respectful state. We can learn lots of things, but we, if we throw away the autonomization, the sentence, and the, I don't know what was the German name this morning, it was not freedom, it was autonomy. And if we take, leave that away, we will not be strong in the fight for new organization, new organizing, new society.
Is it related to this, or so if you can be short, and Raoul can?
I just wanted to comment that indeed, as you said, Hadim has spoken about a kind of commons which never really existed, because this comment is no Westland where there are no rules, and in daily commons are managed by communities. There have been rules about how to manage them, who can use them, in what ways to protect against overuse. And so on. And I think also, as I said in my talk, that any future society which is based on commons will have to need some rules, they will make some rules, as we now see in free software, GPL, and so on. And so rules are always an important part of communities which care for the commons.
Yeah. And I think that somewhere there is a tendency to see money without exchange. And I insist that that's why I almost every time I said money and symmetric exchange. I'm not defending here the idea that the development and the arrival of money was dramatic. It was a progress, as the individualistic aspect of capitalism was a progress in relation to feudalism and all the old community. If we are going to a collective society today, it would be completely different from the old collective societies. I agree if it's this you want to insist on. It will be a collectivity, because we want it. We individuals want it. That was great. Capitalism was a nightmare, but we were obliged to pass through that. But that's, okay, that's capitalism. It's not money in itself. If you want to insist on how capitalism was a freedom from the old story, okay. But that doesn't mean that when we look to the future, just to say, well, capitalism allowed that, but and now what? So what do we do with money? What do we do with change? Because the real question is, and I see it very much, there is a tendency to see money as something in itself. The problem is to say that what is behind money? Why is the need of money? And that's why I prefer to say, don't talk about money, but the necessity of symmetric exchange. I don't give you something if you don't give me the equivalent. It has been Adam Smith, I think, who says money is the way to command the work of others. In the example you give, for example, to keep the elderly, etc. Well, okay, let's take the reality which is behind the money. I think that what is important to see here is what I wanted to insist, that when it arrived, there were aspects of freedom, but there were a lot of aspects of where it destroyed a solidarity which existed before. It brought something new, but any solidarity disappeared. When you are putting in the situation, it's the first time in history, never happened in history, where the old people can die alone in a maison de retraite, in a house for olds, where nobody sees them. You get the money, you don't feel guilty because you pay the money. It never happened in history, never. It's one of the most inhuman aspects of history. And it's possible because of money. Okay, one guy is free. The guy doesn't feel guilt. I pay a lot of money, and he is in a chair, dying, etc. I don't think one guy is free, but the general framework which has been given, which has replaced the old solidarity, field of solidarity, I don't agree.
Just to finish. Quite short. It also never happened in history that our older elderly became 80 and 80 plus. So this is a completely new development that we have to deal with. But I'd like to make a more meta point, yeah, because I think it was important to have those two lines. You have a line of an arrow directed towards the future, and peer production is an intermediate stage. And the other concept is your concept of reapplication of what peer production does to the status quo. So these are two very different ways of looking at things.
I'm sorry, but we have to end this because a few people have to go, and it is time. So thank you very much, Raoul.